Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com, the Challenged Athletes Foundation. That's challengedathletes.org. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville Radio on iTunes or Babbittville.com. Our next guest, the CEO of the most important endurance event on the planet, the Ironman Triathlon, Mr. Andrew Messick. Andrew, how the heck are you?
I'm doing great, Bob. Doing very well.
Wonderful. Hey, so I want to go through a number of things. It's almost like a State of the Union. I'm sort of excited about this. So let's talk. Start out with some of the. When I was down in Texas, I was really impressed. One with the fact that you're doing more of these regional events with bigger prize money, obviously a better elite list. Talk a little bit about that and where that came from.
Well, I think that what we want to be able to do is to have a number of big, important races around the world that capture the imagination of our athletes and that allow, in particular, our professional athletes to race against one another in enhanced fields. One of the challenges that we've had with growth, and we now have more than 40 Ironman races around the world, and more than 70.3s, is that, you know, it's a lot of races, and the top athletes, both male and female, don't race against each other that much because you've got a lot of choices for athletes in every region, and frankly, we thought it would be good for the sport to try to create a system that provides more incentives for the top people to race against one another, and to have that racing take place earlier in the calendar year, so that the top athletes can sort out their qualification for the World Championships relatively early, and then put themselves in a position where they can peak again and be 100% ready for Hawaii in October.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because with all the Ironman events around, it almost became like a golf course where you have one pro per event, and it sort of lost a lot of it lost excitement because you know there wasn't, people were sort of going, oh, so and so is going there, I'll go somewhere else, because it was really, there wasn't that incentive with bigger prize purse and regional championships. So what we're seeing now is the athletes going, hey, you know what? I'm going to Texas because that is a North American championship. That's a title. The other side is, you know, I would get calls from, you know, Cliff Bar and other sponsors going, hey, this guy sent me a note. He's won 8 Ironmans. You know, I've never heard of him. Who is he? You know, that type of thing where the to a certain degree, the winning an Ironman title got a little neutered because they were going to remote events that really didn't have the panache that an Ironman World Championship or a regional championship has. So it's, I think from that perspective, it's made it a little easier for people to put in their contracts. Here's the regional championships. There's X amount of regional championships, and these are the important races as a professional that the sponsors, the media, and the athletes can gauge themselves against.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that isn't lost on us. You know, we want an Ironman championship to be, you know, a big thing. And as you have more and more races around the world, I've said many times before that we're growing the number of races we have faster than we're growing the number of professionals we have. And so that on average field sizes are getting smaller, and in many cases field sizes were getting thinner. And so we think it's in everyone's interest to have, you know, fewer, bigger races with concentrated prize money and an opportunity to tell a more robust and compelling media story around the top guys racing each other, because that's what people want to see. They want to see competition. And so we think we've made some steps in the right direction, and we've tried to enhance the coverage for these events. And so, you know, we're doing, you know, we're putting more behind them in terms of live shows. We've introduced GPS tracking for professionals, and we hope to be able to expand that in the future. And we're trying to create a more compelling media product that's going to capture the imagination of athletes and be able to showcase our professional athletes in a better way.
Talk a little bit about one of the things that was introduced in Texas was Ironman University. And I know you guys have been working on that for a long time. And one of the things that I think what happens is, as a big company owned by private equity, everybody looks at things when you're the big guy and goes, okay, Ironman is just looking for another way to make a few bucks. It's another way to make some dollars. But one of the things you and I were talking about in Texas was you had just gotten back from Vietnam. And if in certain parts of the world, knowing how to train for something like the Ironman or Ironman 70.3, it's not like there's coaches on every corner. So talk about the genesis of Ironman University, and obviously it's something that was just launched, but what are your plans for it moving forward?
Well, I think that the origins of it came from a couple of insights that, you know, that have been hiding in plain sight for a long, long time. And one of them is that we think that athletes are going to perform better with a coach, and that coaching is important, especially in long-distance triathlon, which is arduous, it's complicated, there's lots of moving parts, there's lots of ways to improve performance, and there's lots of ways that an athlete can get derailed at a race, and many of them are preventable. And having somebody to help our athletes and guide them in the journey, we think is really important, and that the likelihood of somebody having the day they want on the day of their A race is just a lot higher if you've got a coach. And it doesn't matter how good you are. It doesn't matter if you're a first-timer. It doesn't matter if you're trying to win Kona. A coach will improve your performance. And we believe that. And again, that's not hugely controversial.
No.
But it's something that we believe in, and we believe in pretty strongly. And because we want our customers to have good experiences at our races, we feel like we've got a vested interest in encouraging our athletes to have coaches. We want our athletes to have their day of days be a good one. We think that it's in our interest as a company. So that opens the door and asks the question, well, so if you're an athlete and you want to get a coach, how do you pick one? And in particular, outside of a place like the United States or Australia or the UK, where there is something called, you know, USA Triathlon, and they have a coaching certification program. But most countries don't. And so if you're a coach or you're an athlete in the Philippines or in Vietnam or in China or in Argentina or in, you know, Poland, how do you determine whether a coach is qualified? You know, how does one discover, other than calling your friend at the tri club and saying, what do you think of this guy? And so that was an unsolved problem for us, and frankly, it's an opportunity, we think, because there are coaching certification programs that are well established and that are you know, reasonably good, we believe. But they're not everywhere, and they're not available to coaches everywhere. And so we think that there's an opportunity for us as a truly global company that operates all around the world to be able to leverage what we know. The other thing that we discovered in the process was that between our master coaches, Dave Scott, Mark Allen, Matt Dixon, Lance Watson, Troy Jacobson, and the subject matter experts, and there's probably 30 of them, of people who have deep expertise in swim, bike, run, so Jerry Rodriguez at Tower 26,
right,
or Jordan Metzl, who's at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, Kristen Armstrong, who just won her, you know, bazillionth, you know, U.S. championship in the time trial last weekend and is a two-time Olympic gold medalist. know, these guys are experts. They're the best in the world at what they do. And so we believe that by casting a wide net and getting literally the best people in the world to contribute their knowledge, that the product that we've created is better than anything that exists in the world. And again, that's not necessarily due to Iron Man, but the people who are involved in our world, there's a lot of people who are remarkably competent and remarkably experienced, and we worked really hard to get the best people in the world to contribute to the curriculum. So we think that there is huge parts of the world that are, you know, that need some form of certification, and there isn't a certification available to them. And then, frankly, we think that ours is, you know, what I told our team is that whatever we produce, it has to be a better mousetrap. It has to be better than anything that exists in the world right now. And our team believes that the coaching certification curriculum, you know, the 12 units that we've created that a coach needs to fulfill to be able to get an Ironman coaching certification, we think it's the best product in the world. We think we have the best, smartest people. We think we've got it delivered in a way. It's a 100% online education system. So people can learn at their own pace. They can go back. They can review the material multiple times. And there's some real innovation in the educational delivery system that we've created. So, you know, we're optimistic, and we think that it's something that's going to be, it will be helpful to our athletes. And frankly, we think it will help, you know, raise the overall level of proficiency and competence within the coaching industry for long-distance triathlon. And so we think that's, you know, both of those things are really positive.
Well, it was interesting because I remember when Paul Hoddle and Paul Nimby Frazier and John Duke ran the multi-sport triathlon camps and people training for Ironman. And I remember Paula telling me, she says, "Bob, you know, some of these people are coming to these camps who are balancing family and work, and they're training more than I am. They're training 40 hours a week plus they're doing everything else." And a lot of it is just people just figuring, hey, if I'm going to go do this thing, I have to do everything. I have to train as a high-end swimmer, a high-end cyclist, high-end runner. And to a certain degree, sometimes it's a matter of toning it back with the athletes rather than them not wanting to do the work because they do too much work and they get injured and don't get to the starting line.
Well, more isn't always better.
Yeah. So the other side of that is when you talk about the global part of Ironman, I was at Texas knowing that there was close to 700 of the participants were part of the All-World Athlete Program, that 1,200 of the 1,800 people who in Kona were part of the All-World Athlete Program. Are you surprised at the acceptance of the All-World Athlete Program and how excited those folks have become about it?
No. We expected this. You know, it's one of the things that we uniquely can do. And, you know, I recall the heyday of my, to the extent that I had a heyday as an age group athlete. In 2006, I was a USA Triathlon honorable mention All-American.
Whoa.
Honorable mention.
There you go.
You know, my one year at it. And, you know, I was 42 years old. And it was a big deal to me.
Absolutely.
And that really planted the seed that it was, you know, the recognition that for performing at a high level, you know, or in my case, a modest level, is something that matters to our athletes. And that we have, because we're a global company and we have races all over the world, you know, between Ironman and 70.3, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're north of 120 races around the world now.
Wow.
And that number is going to go up. So we have a global platform and people race all over the world. And because we've invested in having, you know, a global athlete database, you know, we do have this unique ability to rank our athletes. And to be able to recognize and celebrate you know, the people who are the very, very best. And so being an all-world gold athlete means you're in the top 1% of age group athletes worldwide. And that means you're really good.
Exactly.
And our athletes, they measure everything. They
yes.
pay really careful attention. How they perform matters to them. And we think to be able to recognize the people who are performing at the highest level is something that contributes to the overall experience. And it's something that is valued. And it's something that, we've put a lot of time and effort into the program, but it makes us happy to be able to to recognize the guys who perform at the highest level and to celebrate their excellence.
So 50 women the Kona.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at the history of Ironman with Julie Moss and Kathleen McCartney, mm-hmm. I mean, so much what's made Ironman great and triathlon great is we've always had mm-hmm. equality. From Lynn LeMaire finishing fifth in the second ever Ironman and leading the bike at one point to obviously Paula was one of the first endurance athletes, not just male or female. She was one of the first women to really have a major nutrition sponsor when Pro Optimal came and became involved. With the 50 women, the Kona, I look at it and go, there's 50 guys and there's 35 women. And it's one of those things, it just seems like the right thing to do is to have 50 men and 50 women, similar to women's tennis when Venus Williams brought to the fore, hey, even though, why are we not getting equal prize money? Why are the women not getting equality here in tennis? And even though the men, you could look at it and say, hey, men are playing five sets rather than three sets, but the women were as important on the world stage as the men were. So why not 50 women, the Kona?
Well, I mean, I think the tennis analogy isn't a good one because we always have had prize money equality.
Right.
So, I understand the 50 women to Kona argument, and I know and respect a number of the people who have been forcefully advocating that. We don't think it's the right thing, and we don't think it's the right thing for a couple of reasons.
Okay.
One of them is that right now, being a female professional athlete is a better deal than being a male professional athlete. Female professional triathletes in our sport make more money than men. And I think it might be the only sport in the world where women make more than men.
What do you mean make more than men in terms
We have equal prize money,
mm-hmm.
and we have half as many women to spread it across.
Okay.
Twice as many pro men, half as many pro women, same money. On average, mean and median, from a prize money perspective, women make more. Because field sizes for women are smaller. When a woman professional athlete goes to the start line, the odds of her being in the money are higher. So it's more likely that she is going to get paid than a male today.
Okay.
For qualifying for Kona, I think 23% of eligible females qualified for Kona, 16% of eligible men qualified for Kona. So already we believe that the deck is stacked towards women today. By arbitrarily saying we're going to have the same number of females and males at the start line at Kona, what you're essentially saying is that there should be a different and lower standard of performance and standard of excellence for women than for men. And that we're going to expect less from our female professional athletes than from males. We're going to make it easier for them. And fundamentally, we don't think that's right. And we believe that there should be a single standard of excellence that should govern Kona. And that the system that we have, proportionality, delivers a single standard of excellence. And that is not popular among a number of people, particularly those who advocate for
50 women.
Yeah. And trust me, it would be easier for me to exceed. I would be more popular if I did it. But I don't think it's the right thing to do. I don't think it's the right thing for Ironman, and I don't think it's the right thing for professional female triathletes. I think it is the wrong thing. And I know that I am incurring the wrath of social media by saying that, but part of my job is to look out for everybody and to look out for Ironman, and we fundamentally don't think it's right. And that it doesn't mean I don't have enormous respect for Rachel Joyce and Sarah Gross and a number of others, but I don't agree with them. And so, you know, and by the way, doing, we just don't agree.
Yeah. It's interesting, and I know you don't think the analogy with tennis connects, but from my perspective, I look at it and go, what's the right thing to do, right? When you talk about equality, and to me, yeah, and we can certainly disagree on this, I think 50 women in the Kona, because I just don't think you can win that argument at the end of the day. There's certain things that are, the men could have argued all day long about equality in prize money when you're talking about three sets and five sets. And there was more to argue there. And they're like, you know what? The right thing to do is equality for women.
But here's where the analogy with tennis falls apart,
okay,
at least in my view.
Yeah.
Is that having 128 women in the Wimbledon draw doesn't mean that there's going to be fewer men in the Wimbledon draw. Kona is at capacity. It is stuffed full of athletes. And so to give more slots to one group means you're taking them away from another group. You just are. And so arbitrarily saying, I'm going to give group A or B more slots, I have to take them away from someone. And part of my job is to represent the other groups. And so more slots to female pros means less to either pro men or age group men. And I have to balance that. And so that's part of my responsibility. And so where are those slots going to come from? And, you know, we're trying to make Kona bigger. I get that. And, you know, we have to find a way to do that. But from my perspective, if I can find 10 additional slots, you know, on the pier at Kona, those are going to age group athletes. They're not going to pros. Because I think the number of professional athletes that we have right now at Kona is the right number. And the pressure we're under is to find opportunities for age group athletes to be able to race the world championships, because, you know, 23% of pro women go and 16% of pro men, 3% of age group athletes. And it's more like just over 2% of male age group athletes qualify for Kona. And so when I start thinking about what mouths do I have to feed on the big island?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have to find ways to get more age group athletes into that race. I don't feel a corresponding pressure to find more slots for professionals. And again, I have to look at the entire universe of what's happening at Kona, and pros are only a part of that.
Gotcha. So, speaking of age group athletes, as you and I chatted about this once before, legacy program, as somebody who was trying to get to Kona, right, as an age group guy, you realize that, you know, there's like about a 60-minute gap here that I don't know if I can ever bridge to actually qualify to get to Kona.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that led to the creation of legacy program. Because one of the things that we had for years, there was a lot of angst and a lot of anger and a lot of social media bashing every time we would announce that a celebrity was racing Kona. It was, hey, that spot that went to Gordon Ramsay could have been my age group spot. Why shouldn't I get that? And I think the legacy program is something that really took a lot of that anger and dissipated it because it gave people a track. They know that if they do X amount of Ironman events, they can get to Kona. Was that what was behind that? It's like, listen, I personally know how tough it is to get to Kona, and I know how important it is to get to Kona. I want to give you an opportunity to fulfill your dream and get to the most important race on the planet.
The idea for Legacy was always to find a way for people who are dedicated to the life to give them a chance, because there are people who are passionate Ironman athletes out there who have raced with us for years and years and years, who just aren't genetically gifted enough to be able to be one of the 3% who KQ.
Sure.
And those people are no less committed, they're no less passionate, they're no less engaged in the community. They're the ones who are out there every day, leading tri clubs and bringing new people into the sport and being great role models for athletes around the world. And those guys deserve it. And I think the program has really worked, in that we've gotten a large number of people who are deeply passionate about our sport into Kona. And I like the fact that it has never been a probabilistic type of initiative. You don't need luck. You need to do it. And if you fulfill the criteria, you will eventually get a spot at Kona. It may not be this year, maybe next year, but so far we've been able to tell every qualified athlete, you're either going to race this year or you're going to race next year. And again, we've done that in this go round, that we've got 100, actually we're going to have a little bit more than 100 in 2015. We've also filled the 2016 class. So, everybody who fulfilled the criteria knows that they'll either race in 2015 or 2016. And so, we're happy with that. We're happy with the program.
So you're a Women for Tri program, and you've got a board, and the folks are down in Texas. What are the ideas to get more women involved with the sport of triathlon, which is great. I love what you guys did with the Commit to Tri program with Lifetime Fitness, getting brand new people into the sport. What are some of the objectives and what are some of the plans with the women for Tri to get more women in the sport?
Well, what we focused our efforts on so far is really trying to understand what are the root causes that are limiting participation in triathlon relative to running. The running business, I think marathons are around
60%.
40. Yeah, half marathons are 62% in the United States, and marathons I think are maybe about 45% female.
Right.
And both of those numbers are going up. And we're for us, between Ironman and 70.3, we're in the low 30s. It's a little higher for 70.3, it's a little lower for full distance Ironman. But there's a huge gap, and that gap is opportunity for us. And so if 60% or more than 60% of half marathon runners are female, why is it twice as likely that a half marathon runner be female compared to a triathlete? And so we think that's an opportunity, and so we've spent a lot of time trying to understand what are the root causes, and we think that none of them are insurmountable, and that they relate to mentorship, they relate to information, they relate to some of the differences just fundamentally between men and women, and that men are dramatically more likely to say, I'm going to do an Ironman. I'm going to sign up for it. It's a year away. I'll figure out how to
Be
ready. And women are much more likely to say, I'm going to figure it out, and once I've figured it out, then I'm going to commit.
Right.
And so, but we've never articulated how do you figure it out. And so women have been largely left on their own to navigate, like, how do I get ready? How do I prepare? What do I have to do? How much do I train? What equipment do I need? There's a million practical questions, and they're not immediately apparent. And so part of what our board has been advocating to us is we need to put in place a whole series of basic information and basic processes that are going to lower the barriers to get people to say yes. And they're around information, they're around mentorship, they're around structured programs at clubs, at things like health clubs, but there are also structured programs in triathlon clubs. Like, how do we find ways to gently introduce people to our sport and give them the information and the confidence that they need to be able to say, I could do that. And, you know, and none of it is brain surgery, but it's something that we've never done as a sport. We've always, as a sport, left it to people's own devices how to get to the start line. And we think that by being a little bit more proactive, a little bit more thoughtful, and a little bit more aggressive, we can invite women to participate, and that if we invite them, they'll say yes.
So I just watching the growth with rock and roll in terms of number of women in the half marathon specifically, a lot of that came through the charity programs. Women got into Team of Training and Crohn's and Colitis as a way of fundraising and had a bucket item of finishing a marathon or finishing a half marathon. And then they either did the event and disappeared or did the event, liked it, and stayed on board. But it came from charity, right? It came from, I want to do this for somebody else, and they found that was good for them. Do you think that's something that maybe we need to do more of in triathlon to get women involved?
Well, there's no doubt that it's been very powerful for rock and roll. It's been very powerful for the New York Marathon. It's been very powerful for the London Marathon. That having a cause matters.
Yes.
And part of the psychology of women as it relates to, you know, how do I justify the time that I'm going to spend preparing relative to the time that I spend with my family, relative to the time that I spend with work, that's an important question. And it's one that we've spent a fair amount of time talking about. Again, men are more likely to just say, I'm going to do it, I'm going to figure it out. And part of the decision-making process for women is, how do I justify spending time, money, and resources on myself rather than on any of the other number of competing priorities that I have in my life? And charity partnerships, you know, play a powerful role in that.
So when I look at the lottery program, which it sounds like it went away through the government getting involved. Can you explain what happened with the lottery program and if there's plans to bring it back in a different form?
Well, according to the federal government, for more than 30 years, we have been operating an illegal gambling enterprise.
I had no idea. That is so
I had no idea either.
Wow.
So the fundamental aspects of the lottery are unchanged since we started it in 1983.
Right. Yeah, that was something that Valerie Silk always wanted, just like John and Judy. Right. They wanted the average person to always have an opportunity to race in Kona.
Yeah. So by the way,
yeah.
Just so you know,
yeah,
that technically, like, if you have a raffle,
yeah,
you're engaged in an illegal gambling enterprise. I'm trying to protect you.
Oh, yeah. No, we learned that with CAF years ago. Somebody was like, hey, why don't we auction off a Porsche and do it as a fundraiser for CAF? And when we started looking at all the numbers on it and all the things you had to do, or if somebody doesn't have to buy a ticket, they can do it for free because it's illegal to force some. Otherwise, it's gambling. So we're like, you know, we're out. This is.
So I've learned more about chance, prize, and consideration than I ever thought I would.
Yeah.
But But so, you know, the federal government believes that the lottery is an illegal gambling enterprise. We think they're wrong, by the way.
Yeah.
But at some point, a company our size fighting the federal government is just a losing battle.
Yeah. And it's a lot of money for attorneys for what?
Well, it's a lot of money for attorneys. That's for sure. But I think even more importantly is the impact on the organization, the amount of focus, attention, effort.
Right.
We're a small company. You know, we're not Google. We're not IBM. You know, we're a small company that, you know, that has limited resources and a limited amount of capacity to do things. And so getting dragged into what would be a multi-year dispute with the feds,
yeah,
you know, that would really limit our ability to do lots and lots and lots of other things. And it wasn't worth the fight. But that doesn't mean we think that there's anything wrong with the lottery. Doesn't mean that we think we did anything wrong. Doesn't mean we think that the lottery is illegal. You know, we think that the lottery is a perfectly fair and legal mechanism for allocating a very, very scarce resource. And there's some case law that supports our position. The question is, you know, the only way to decide and to definitively determine whether the lottery is legal or illegal is to slug it out in court. And we just weren't prepared to do it. So
how does did the government basically just out of nowhere go, hey, we've discovered this lottery and it's illegal?
Well, I mean, Jimmy Munch, who is the lead assistant U.S. attorney on the case, you know, is an Ironman athlete, and you know, he's never signed up for the lottery, but he certainly gets, you know, he gets marketing material from us.
Yeah,
and so, you know, the lottery's never been, you know, it's never been a secret.
No.
So, you know, who knows? Who knows where it came from? But ultimately, that isn't important. So, you know, we have to figure out how do we continue to fulfill the, you know, the Collins' vision, and to do that in a way that works for our business, but also works for the broader Ironman community.
And for the feds.
And for the feds.
Exactly.
Who, by the way, yeah.
Yeah. So we were talking a year ago at the CEF event, and you were talking about that a few years ago, the brand invested in a deep dive to find out more about your participants, to really understand your consumers. What did you learn from that deep dive into the heart and soul of your business?
Well, I think that the most fundamental thing is that our athletes are extraordinary. You know, there's nothing average about them. They are, you know, a unusual and very, very rare group of high achieving, goal focused, success oriented people. You have to be to do an Ironman, and you have to have a ton of determination, a ton of grit, a unusual willingness to be able to sacrifice, you know, time, you sacrifice sleep, sacrifice at work, sacrifice time with your family. And those are all characteristics that make people successful in other aspects of life. So, you know, part of what is, you know, really a pleasure to be a part of in this organization is that, you know, our athletes are remarkably successful people in whatever they put their mind to. And that could be banking, it could be surgery, it could be law, it could be engineering, but just as a population of people, they are an extraordinary bunch, and that puts a lot of pressure on us, because, you know, we have to be able to capture their attention and keep it, and make them inspired enough to want to live this life and do our races and be a part of the broader, you know, global endurance community. And so, you know, we have our work cut out for us, and we spend a ton of time really being thoughtful about, you know, how do we create great experiences, and how do we capture people's imagination, and how do we keep it? Because as I tell my organization all the time, when you're dealing with extraordinary people, those extraordinary people have lots of options with how to spend their time and how to spend their money. And if we're not very, very, very good at what we do, they'll find some other way to spend their time and money.
Well, I was talking to a group the other day about the endurance entertainment market. And we're talking Spartan Race, Tough Mudder, Iron Man, Grand Fondo. There's more options than ever before, which makes it imperative that if, you know, for your brand, that you have to do it better than ever. You have to do it better if people are going to continue to come and not go, this was a bucket list event, I did it, the Iron Man, and I'm done. Rather than, hey, I love the experience, I want to travel and do something else with the Iron Man brand on it.
Yeah, and look, I don't view our competition as other race formats. I mean, our competition is, you know, taking, you know, instead of doing Ironman this year, you know, I'm going to take my family to Italy.
Mm.
And so the, you know, those are the types of things that, you know, that are the alternative for us. It's not, am I going to do race X versus race, you know, race Y? It's, you know, do I want to spend, you know, the next 6 months training, preparing for an event, or do I want to do something that's just easier?
Exactly.
And so, I mean, that's the thing that keeps me up at night and makes me highly, highly, highly focused on the athlete experience and on creating, you know, things like the All World Athlete Program to, you know, to get people excited and fired up about, you know, being a part of our community, because, you know, our athletes have choices. There's no doubt about it.
So about, actually, I don't know if it was a year ago, it was probably a little less than a year ago, Ironman teamed up and purchased Super Frog here in Southern California,
mm-hmm.
which event with a great legacy going back to 1979 and Mokey Martin, and really was a training, the event was created as a training race for the Ironman.
Mm-hmm. And oldest.
Yes.
Half Ironman distance race in the world.
Exactly. And we chatted, gosh, just last summer sometime, because Moki was ready to move on, and connecting the two brands, Ironman and Super Frog, which just seemed as a natural to me. From now that you've been involved with it and been involved with that group, what is it about? Because I almost look at Super Frog as a boutique type event. It's not like you can put 3,000 people out there. What was it about that event that appealed to you?
Well, I think that, you know, a race that, you know, has so much history, and it's not just history in time, but it's history with, you know, with the Navy and in particular, you know, Naval Special Warfare. That link, you know, goes all the way back to the very beginning, you know, to the Collinses and, you know, the global endurance community that really started in San Diego. And started with, you know, the Navy SEALs and the UDT guys, you know, of which, you know, Moki was one. And so for us, it is a boutique race. You know, we have a capacity of 800 athletes. And, you know, we've reserved 300 of those slots for, you know, for military personnel. You know, it is a Kona qualifier for active duty military personnel. And, you know, and we think that, you know, we're trying to continue to celebrate and honor the link between Ironman and the military and in particular, you know, the Navy. And it's a cool race.
It is a cool race.
You know, hard.
Brutal.
You know,
especially the run.
You know, and so, you know, Moki was telling me the other day, he's like, you know, in some years as much as 11 miles of the run is on soft sand.
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah.
And like my eyes almost popped out of my head. But you know, hard swim, you know, the bike on the Silver Strand is really the limiter to the size of that event. You know, it's multi-loop. There's no other place to put it. And so, you know, we have it, you know, it's a small race, 500 age group slots. It's all we can put there, and so, you know, we think it's a great race for the military community, But we also think it's a great race for age groupers, you know, because you know we've got the usual number of world championship slots, and it is by our standards a very, very, very small age group field. So we think there's a lot to offer there.
Exactly. The other side is for military folks, they can qualify for Kona at a half, which is very nice.
Yep. And for military folks, for 2015, you could qualify as a military athlete at Super Frog or Ironman Melbourne or the 70.3 in Wiesbaden is also a military qualifier for 2015. But it is great, we think, to be able to allow some athletes to punch their ticket to Kona at a 70.3, because there aren't very many 70.3 qualifiers left.
No. Well, I appreciate you being open enough to take a look at that event, because I think it's a great addition to Ironman, and I could tell with Moki it was time. He's got a lot of challenges in his life with, you know, being quadriplegic and going a couple bouts of cancer and wanting to keep that event going and being a one-man show, and now he's got the power of Ironman behind him, which is wonderful.
It's gonna be a great race. If I can negotiate my way out there, I may try to do that race this year.
Ah, you will love it, except for the sand. But you'll dig the sand. You're one of those guys. Speaking of that, how important is it for the CEO to be out there racing? And what have you learned from? It's one thing to be watching, but to be part of it, you learn a lot from the athletes. And these aren't just athletes; these are your customers.
I mean, I've always been an age group triathlete. So I've been doing this for more than a decade, and there's no better way to learn about the races. There's no better way to interact with your customers, and it's something that I enjoy. I live the life like everybody else, so I have to figure out how to manage my job and my family and training and all of that. And so I'm no different than anyone else in that respect. But I think it's good to be reminded of that frequently, because it's easy to, if you're not in regular deep contact with your customers, it's really easy to lose sight of the real pulse of what's happening. And what's happening for us happens at races. So I'm terrible. I'm worse than I've ever been. But what I always tell people is it's better to race and suck than not to race.
Exactly. I remember standing at a group of guys in the 60 to death category last year at a race at Camp Pendleton, and it's like 5 in the morning and we're standing there and it's like, why do we do this? And then all of us almost in unison, because we can, right? Because you're still physically able to get out there, and there's just nothing better than, it's the fountain of youth. It's the best sport there is. So the other thing that I just saw came across the other day was the two-day 70.3 World Championships in, I think, 17. I love that. Yep. I think that's going to be such a huge impact for whatever city you're doing it in, having the women on one day and the men on the next day. Good reception on that?
Yeah, the reception's been great. We've got, all of these things, they come from, challenges and issues that we have. And the challenge and the issue that we have is that we have more than 80 qualifying races for 70.3 Worlds now, and the demand to race in the 70.3 World Championship is going up, 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 and there's more athletes from around the world who wanna race, and we're very we're in the process of outstripping our ability to have a one day race of the standard that we think is required. A world championship race should be a fabulous experience for athletes. All the details should be right. It should be, it needs to be fantastic. And we're just getting to the point of so many qualifying races, you either have to make the choice that every race is going to be a 25 or 30 slot race, which means you have to win your age group to go, or we have to find another way to be able to get more athletes so that we can have 40 or 50 qualifying slots. you know, at our races. And so having a 2-day event became a fairly, you know, a fairly straightforward decision. And, you know, how are one of the challenges that we've been grappling with forever is how do you have a clean race for the women? And so, you know, there's an ongoing, continuous, decade-long, you know, dialogue around how do you keep, you know, front of the pack age group men from interfering in the women's pro race.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, that one is as old as time.
Yep.
And you know, and we try, and I think we've succeeded by and large at our biggest races in being able to create a relatively clean race. But it's not easy. And then you've also got a huge ongoing issue of, you know, the commingling of the male and the female age group races, and having, you know, women be able to sit in men's swim packs and to be able to get out and race with, you know, with the fast biker guys. And there's, you know, again, there's a long, long, long dialogue about, you know, how do you clean that up? And so one way to clean it up is just like have the men and the women race on a different day.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, you know, the pro women, you know, are going to be, you know, completely unaffected by age group men, and you know, they get the privilege and the honor to be the one who takes the tape first.
Exactly.
And I think that's great. I think it's a great step for us. I think it's a great opportunity to be able to showcase women's racing both from an age group and a professional perspective. And you know, who knows where it'll lead. But having 2 days of, you know, having 2 days of racing operationally creates a bunch of challenges for us, but they're all challenges that we think we can handle. But we'll see. I think it'll be like having a woman's day will be great. And it also, you know, going back to our earlier conversation about how do you think about slot allocation, you decouple men's and women's slot allocation and it stops being zero sum.
Exactly.
And, you know, we're highly sensitive to the fact that, you know, especially at Kona, every slot comes at the expense of someone else. All of a sudden, when you have 2 days of racing, that completely goes away. It goes right out the window. And so, you know, we can have, if we choose to, we can have the exact same number of slots, male and female, for pros and for age groups. And then there, you can have a thoughtful conversation about, you know, do you care about whether, you know, the standard of people in that race is different or the same? But I think there is a thoughtful conversation to be had there.
So is that, you know, first, the cities, Ironman's an impactful event, or even 70.3. You're blocking off roads, you're impacting people going to church, all that stuff. When you had those discussions with Chattanooga and with St. George and Lake Placid, they were obviously open to, hey, we'll bring it on. We'll block off our city for 2 days for this event.
Well, for twice as many athletes,
yeah.
Twice as many hotel room nights.
Exactly, yeah.
There's a lot of impact. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, and part of, you know, what we've been engaged in thoughtful dialogue with Chattanooga and with St. George and with Placid about how do you do it in a way that makes sense. And, you know, so we're still, you know, this is something we have to convince ourselves of. You know, we'll see you in Austria this year. You know, we have an age group race the day before the 70.3 World Championships. And that will be our first real test of concept. Can you have races back to back and not have them impact one another? Because in Austria, you know, we need to be thoughtful that on Saturday we've got all of our world championship athletes. They're going to want to go to the swim venue and do a practice swim. They're going to want to ride their bikes a little bit. They're going to need to rack their bikes. there's a whole bunch of things that need to happen the day before a world championship event. And, you know, the art of what we're doing operationally is how do you create a age group race on Saturday that doesn't interfere with our world championship athletes and their ability to be ready on Sunday. And so, you know, I won't take you into the plumbing of all of that, but there is a lot of plumbing, and it's going to be a very, very, very complicated weekend for us with lots and lots of moving parts, and you know, but we're optimistic that we'll handle it.
Do you see that as something, because with people with the speed that people are finishing the Ironman World Championship, is that feasible down the line to do a 2-day there?
To do
Kona, 1 day men, 1 day women. Is that even feasible? That's a lot of plumbers. We're bringing a lot of plumbers to the table here, Andrew.
Well, so there's issues about whether you can get the road closures. There's issues about whether you can get enough volunteers. There's issues about whether you can get enough people in the med tent. But if you're
talking about doubling the number of people.
But if you race. You know, Saturday, Sunday, let's say.
Yeah.
So if you're racing on Sunday, when do you rack your bike?
I think what they do is you, Saturday, as those people are finishing, because you got most of your people, I'm assuming, by 13 hours are done. So it's they're coming in at, people are coming in that evening. Or do you separate it by a day? Do you have a Friday, Sunday, or a Saturday, Monday?
So, I mean, but in all of this, you know, the devil's in the details.
Yes.
And there's a lot of details, and that the, you know, as we think about how do you operationally manage things, there's what seems obvious may or may not be possible.
Right.
And so, you know, we there's a lot of things we look at, but ultimately, you know, our first obligation is to create great events for our athletes.
Exactly.
And so we're very conservative, particularly with Kona, that what we have to first and foremost do is not screw it up.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. Andrew, I want to thank you for taking so much time. Always, always a pleasure to chat. And we might not agree on everything, but the one thing that I'm a fan. I think you've done an amazing job of taking a lot of people's anger over different things, like the legacy program has been wonderful, and the all-world athlete. And, you know, down the line, hopefully we'll get 50 women to Kona. That would be great.
Well, if we have enough pro female triathletes, then that's the way to solve it. But let me more broadly say that I appreciate the passion that people have for Ironman.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that while, you know, part of my job is, you know, to absorb people's dissatisfaction, I understand that it comes from a place of passion and you know, commitment and in many cases love. And so, you know, no one likes being a punching bag, but being a punching bag because people genuinely care about Ironman and want it to be better, makes it a lot better.
The reality is that the one thing you don't want as an event guy or in any business, you don't want vanilla. I used to say that with Competitor Magazine. I would much rather somebody call me up and go, I can't believe you're not doing more on ultra running. I can't believe you're not doing this or that, rather than going, it was a crappy magazine, and not saying anything, and me not knowing that I had a dissatisfied person. The fact that people are putting tattoos on their body, and you've got, 140 events around the world, obviously the brand resonates. So yeah, you're going to get, anytime you do that, Dr. Gills, who used to be the owner of the Ironman, told me at one point, says, anytime you stick your head above the crowd, people are going to be there to take a swing at it. So that's, you guys have stuck your head above the crowd because you're trying to be the best event on the planet, and obviously people want to be there. So you're doing the right stuff.
Well, I appreciate that, Bob.
Hey.
And looking forward to seeing you at the races.
Love it. Again, we are brought to you by RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com, ChallengedAthletes.org, and Babbittville Radio. Check out all of our interviews on iTunes or BabbittvilleRadio.com. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.